New year, new nonsense. Every year.
Hello and welcome to Opposition Cast. I'm Nigel Fletcher, and it has to be said it's a little while since I last spoke to you. What I think I've discovered during the course of 2023 is that trying to write two or three different books at the same time as holding down a job and keeping up a regular podcast series was never really going to work, so I've not been able to do this as often as I would have liked to, but we're back for a new year. New year, new nonsense, as Keir Starmer so memorably put it at Prime Minister's Questions last week. And 2024 is, I think, going to be a very exciting year. We are almost certain that there will be a general election. The only other alternative would be if the Prime Minister decides to hold out till the very last possible moment and hold the election in January of next year. That doesn't look quite as likely as it might have done in the past. He's all but ruled that out and said that this will be an election year and that his working assumption is that it will be towards the second half of the year. So the smart money is on it being held sometime around November, possibly October, and that the party conferences will probably go ahead beforehand, which is great news for those of us who are determined this year to try and get to all three of them, which I've been trying to do for quite a long time and never quite made it. So we're going to have a very exciting year in British politics, but there's also lots going on around the world as well, not least the US presidential election, which is taking place in November, with the potential of a return of Donald Trump, who seems to be closing in on the Republican nomination again, whilst simultaneously trying to keep himself out of prison, it appears. So lots going on the other side of the Atlantic as well, and all the way around the rest of the world. I don't have the list here, but I'm sure someone's got a list. There's a lot of elections happening around the world this year. 2024 is going to be quite an interesting year for politics all around the world. So what better time to crank up the podcast and get back to some more regular recordings? There's going to be a lot to discuss, certainly in British politics, which is usually our main focus. And today is a particularly appropriate day to be beginning the new series, because last night the klaxon went off in opposition studies towers, all of those who study these things will have noted that we had a particularly important milestone in what could be, if we look at the polls at the moment, a potential transition of Labour into office, which was that Sir Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, has written to the Cabinet Secretary formally requesting the beginning of what are known as access talks with the civil service. Those are the meetings in which Shadow Secretaries of State, members of the Shadow Cabinet, can speak to civil servants on a confidential basis to brief them on their plans should they take office. And so we are looking at certainly the very real prospect of that taking place, although of course anything can happen in politics, but it is the signal that we are in the run-up to a general election, and there has been some controversy that it hasn't begun even earlier. This is something which is in the gift of the Prime Minister to give the nod for, to allow this to start, and he hadn't done that until I think last week, given the nod that it could actually begin. So there have been some controversy over that, and we'll be talking about that later on in the programme with our very good friend, Dr. Catherine Haddon of the Institute for Government, who is a world expert on this whole process and on preparations for government. We've talked about it before, but as I say, it has a particular resonance now that this process is now getting underway. And the Institute for Government itself, where Kath has been for many years, writing about these sorts of subjects, held a very interesting panel discussion a couple of weeks ago to launch their new report. The report is called Preparing for Government: How the Official Opposition Should Ready Itself for Power. And the event was a very interesting one, which I was pleased to go along to. And I'm just going to play a few clips from that to give you a flavour of it. You can watch the whole thing on their website, and I recommend you do so if you're interested. And also the report is also available to download. But the event was talking about preparations for government, and it featured Wes Ball, the former director of the Parliamentary Labour Party, Baroness Fall, Kate Fall, the former Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron, who was involved in the transition to government that happened in 2010. Kath Haddon herself was on the panel, and also Lord McPherson, the former Permanent Secretary at the Treasury, who saw the transition into power of George Osborne at that time in 2010, and he was on the panel too. So I've got some extracts from that just to introduce the topic, and beginning with Baroness Fall, Kate Fall, another former opposition cast guest, who spoke about the importance of these access talks and of preparations for government, but began by saying that there is another consideration that people have to take into account when you're looking at an opposition that's heading into an election.
So if you're working in a political team heading into a general election, your entire focus is on winning. So I think the first problem in this discussion about transition is even the whole thing is election, election, election. And the thing you most dread is complacency, either at the ballot box or within your team, or a sense of hubris. Hubris is literally the killer of a general election campaign and is often comes into the end of a campaign. We can think of so many examples, but it really is something that turns time and time again. So literally none of the inner team on an election campaign will be thinking really about transition. What you will be thinking of, however, is your manifesto, what are your big offers, your big retail offers, what are you selling to the people of Britain? And that obviously is something that the civil service will be looking at sort of very, very closely indeed. And then you are also thinking about, if you won, who would be in your government? Because those people are already in your team, they're already your shadow cabinet. Not all of them, by the way, will make it over that transition. And of course, in this particular election, we formed a coalition 5 or 6 days after that election, and the people who thought they were going to get those posts didn't all get them, and that caused a whole raft of other problems. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing I would say is there is a sense of we did, of course, work on a grid with the possibility of coming into government. And that would be focusing on, how can we show the country we've changed? How can we show the country what the values are of this new government? And we were very aware of when it had been done successfully in the past, like with Gordon Brown and Blair with the Bank of England. So symbolic value-led first days was very much in focus. And there were some people working on transition. I believe George Osborne, but Nick will talk about that, saw Nick in the run-up of that. But on the whole, I would say the main positive and negative is that you really are just focused on clinching that deal with the electorate.
Kate Fall there, who was with David Cameron and his team as they went into government. And her main point there, of course, being about the laser focus that the opposition tends to have on winning the election. And that's a point that was picked up by Wes Ball, who was the former director of the Parliamentary Labour Party, who went through the similar process in 2015. Admittedly, that didn't then lead to a change in government, but the same discussions were held with the civil service, and there was quite an extensive preparation for government that took place then. Here are his thoughts.
Absolutely. And That's one of the lessons that we learned from the 2009-10 experience, was the need to separate out your team that's thinking about how you will run the government, how you will deliver the policies that you've put in your manifesto, the other commitments you've made. We were thinking about how to separate that out from the politics, because the brilliant people you've got that are going to form the core of your government are just focusing on the election campaign. And that is right. That is the right thing to do. So you do need another team that can think in a kind of much more prosaic, programmatic, managerial sense about how you're going to do it. What are the choices that you're going to have to face in the first few weeks, few months, so that there is a plan that you can provide to people to get going with when you do that. And that was separating that out was a really important lesson that we learned. And I think that was really effective for us. And I think it's a lesson that the current Labour leadership are also operating on. And I think it will have benefits for them.
Wes Ball there on his reflections on 2015. And finally on the panel, Lord McPherson, the former Permanent Secretary at the Treasury, gave his thoughts and recollections on it. And going back to this theme about the fact that the opposition is a little busy with other things at the time that they start to engage with the civil service.
The opposition is generally in the business of trying to win. It does not want to spend lots of time talking to boring civil servants, but and who can blame them? But the discussions do provide an opportunity first to build a relationship so that when the government gets in, you can hit the ground running. And secondly, to get a sense of what the immediate priorities are and were. So Kate actually has triggered a memory that a week before the election, George Osborne got in touch and said, can you come around? And he wanted to make clear that if the Tories did get in, within a week to 10 days, they would want to announce a whole lot of in-year cuts in public spending. So, you know, there were a whole lot of things which George Osborne wanted to do quickly. We spent the election period working on those along with lots of other things. And I'd like to think we were reasonably ready to hit the ground running, even though there was a coalition which actually gave us another 10 days or so, or a week. It did mean, though, that life... I remember going round to the Department for Trade because I'd been Ken Clark's private secretary in the 90s to give them tips on working with Ken Clark. But then, because of the coalition, Vince Cable became the president of the Board of Trade, which meant all my hard work and useful tips came to nothing, and I was too busy to talk to the Minister of Justice when he was belatedly appointed.
Lord McPherson there on some of the practicalities of a change of government and change of personnel in government as well. That's something that we'll come back to in our next discussion as well, because the one person we didn't hear from in those clips there, who was also on the panel at that excellent event the other week at the Institute for Government, was Programme Director, in-house historian and friend of the podcast, Dr. Catherine Haddon. And she, of course, had a lot to say during that. But I thought it would be a great way to start the podcast series, given that we are talking about this issue of transitions to government and is her mastermind specialist subject. Who better to be our first guest on the new series? So I caught up with Kath a little bit earlier. Right, so we've now got a clash of the podcasts, because joining me from the Inside Briefing podcast studio at the Institute of Government is Dr. Catherine Haddon. Thanks for joining us, Kath.
Hi, Nigel. Always good to be here.
Great. Well, at the event that we've just heard a few clips from just now, we had a bit of a discussion afterwards, after that event took place, and discussed the fact that at the time we were speaking, access talks hadn't been authorised. I think it's testament to the power of the IFG that your report that came out at the start of the year was calling for them to be activated. And we got the klaxon last night. So it's finally happened. So do you think it's a timely activation of that process?
I think it is, yeah. And obviously at the start of the year, we were trying to press or just emphasize the importance of them getting going as soon as possible. I think we said they should start by the end of January, and last night's briefing suggested that that was exactly the timetable that people are going for. I mean, could be pure coincidence. But the reason was that it's getting to the point at which the momentum needs to start, because you can start the sounding gong for access talks, you know, the Prime Minister authorising them and the Leader of the Opposition writing to request that they now start. But it still takes a bit of time to get up and running. Once permanent secretaries have been given the green light, they will start contacting shadows. And I'm sure similarly, Keir Starmer's office will be talking to the Cabinet Office about the process, but it still takes time to get meetings in diaries. You know, these are all incredibly busy people. And then even then, you know, once you've had like the first meetings or so, it still takes a bit of time for you to get into the rhythm of them. So just time creeps on. And although obviously Rishi Sunak has now said that his working assumption is that the election will be in the second part of the year, everyone is still wanting to be prepared if there is a sudden early election. So I think there is that kind of urgency now among everyone that it is important to start getting on with these.
Because there have been occasions in the past, haven't there, where there's been very little time for them to take place. We're now looking, as you say, at maybe 10 months or so, looking at the October-November election. But it could be earlier than that. But that's not the shortest amount of time that there's ever been. There have been some shorter ones, haven't there?
Yeah, definitely. Whenever there is a very sudden election, so 2017 is probably the most recent example, because obviously at that moment when Theresa May said, "I am calling an election," you know, that pretty much kicked it off. There was a bit of time for parliamentary wash up, but you were almost immediately into the election campaign. And Labour's Andrew Fisher, who was, I think, director of policy, but working on policy for Jeremy Corbyn at the time, has said that it was a real rush and a scramble. And the talks were very useful to them because they, you know, didn't have all of their policies fleshed out. And even for policies that they were happy to be in the manifesto and be tested on, they hadn't really thought them through in terms of what if we get into government. And the talks helped them flesh out that thinking. So even when they happen during an election campaign, they can still be incredibly important. But it is a real scramble then, especially when you are really, as an opposition, very focused on the campaign itself, quite understandably.
Mm. And as I said, there was a bit of disquiet starting to arise a couple of weeks ago when you had that event, that they hadn't been authorised. The process, as we've talked about, is that the cabinet secretary runs the process, but he's not the one who authorises it, is he? It's the prime minister. So is there a problem there that it's in the hands of the prime minister whether they're allowed to take place at all?
Yeah, I think it is. I was, you know, rereading with historians. It's what we do. The 1964 discussion, when these first kicked off under Alec Douglas-Hume, when Labour were thinking about splitting the Treasury and so wanting to talk about machinery of government changes. And the Prime Minister's principal private secretary then said, you know, that the problem is this is really the opposite of justice. It ought to be done, but it really mustn't be seen to be done. And that's always been the difficulty for incumbent governments, is they're very uncomfortable with giving the civil service permission to start thinking about, you know, basically cheating on them, going to another party to start thinking about another government. And that's how it feels. Mostly they understand the importance. They understand that it works for both sides. They're, you know, both have been in opposition, both have benefited from this. But still, for incumbent prime ministers, it can be an uncomfortable process. And there is a bit of confusion about what is that initial process kicking it off, and how the prime minister authorises it, and the leader of the opposition requesting them to actually start. So from my point of view, I think it's got to the point where these are a recognised part of the timetable going into an election. We ought to be able to trust the civil service that they will begin them at an appropriate time. You could put a date on it of saying these can start a year and a half out from the expected end of a parliament, because that will catch most early elections, because, you know, when a government is powerful, it might go for an earlier election, but it's usually a year before the end of parliament. So it would still allow for that opportunity. It won't capture every opportunity where there is an early election, but it will cover most of them. And the civil service should know to continue to focus on serving the government of the day and not letting them be a distraction. So I think we ought to trust them on that, and just stop it being a political football and accept that it is a regular part of how our system of government works.
Mm. And that's on the timing. What about the scope of them? Because, as you say, they began with the model of 1964. There were some very specific machinery of government changes that were being proposed by the incoming Wilson government at that time. And so they were quite focused on that. But we seem to have sort of almost got stuck in that mode. Is that a problem as well, that they are quite restrictive in terms of what they can discuss?
Well, it's more that the official guidance is quite restrictive, or says that these are allowed to be about machinery of government. The reality is that everyone knows these are about the opposition forewarning about policy plans. Pretty much all policy plans, you know, have a machinery of government implication, even if it's just, well, we need to move this policy team to there, or, you know, move these teams around or whatever. It might not be as big as we're creating a new department. But the reality is they're about forewarning of policy plans, and we should recognise that. I think there are areas where it is still quite useful to have a bit of flexibility and perhaps even a grey area around what gets discussed. Because again, I think you've got to trust the judgment of permanent secretaries in what they can't do and can't discuss. They know, and it, you know, guidance has usually been pretty explicit that they cannot be a source of policy advice. They can't sit there and sort of say, let me work through these plans with you and tell you exactly what you should do. And similarly, they cannot give out confidential information about, you know, what's going on inside government, discussions that have been had, sensitive information and so forth. But on the latter, there's so much information in the public domain, it's quite easy for permanent secretaries to be able to talk about things that the opposition might find when they come into government and problems that might exist, even if they're talking about them in general terms and not about very specific things. And similarly, permanent secretaries can ask questions about the policy plans that the opposition have that in a way might guide the opposition to realise that, maybe they should think about this aspect or that aspect. If they're sort of saying, well, you know, have you thought about this in terms of implementing this? Gus O'Donnell, talking to him, he said that, you know, it could often be an arched eyebrow to sort of indicate a moment. There is a risk there that it just becomes the civil service almost become too artful and shadows are sort of sitting there thinking, why is this guy being super weird with me? What's going on here? So they need to know that that's the limit of what the civil service can talk about and why some of the discussions have to be very carefully managed. So there, I think it does have to be about caution and trusting people in the room rather than you can be overly prescriptive about how you have the conversation, what you can talk about. But I think recognising that these are about forewarning the civil service of plans for government and being allowed to discuss that within the limits of the civil service aren't going to start serving the opposition, I think that should be recognised as the reality of what goes on here.
And I have to say, listening to the panel discussion the other week, it did sort of bring back some memories, because in a former life I did have the privilege, I suppose I could say, of actually taking part in some of the access meetings that took place ahead of the 2005 election for the Conservatives. Obviously, rather an academic exercise in that case, but I do remember I was doing education policy, and we met with the permanent secretary, Sir David Normington, at the time, from the Department for Education, who, exactly as you say, that raised eyebrow in a very civil service way, raised a few questions about the how ambitious the proposals were. To, I don't know if you remember or if listeners will remember, that Michael Howard was very keen to have a timetable for action for that election, that he set out in great detail what the Conservatives would do if they won the election, on a timetable of days, weeks, and then months. And there was quite a lot that was supposed to be happening in the first month. And I do remember David Normington sort of doing a very, yes, minister, this is quite a challenging agenda. I think there was a couple of things on sort of setting up a schools funding agency to fund schools at the same time as cancelling tuition fees, which everyone forgets was a policy at the time as well. And it was couched in terms of the capacity of the department to do it. But it was certainly a bit of a warning shot to say this may not be achievable. But one thing that struck me about that, which I wanted to ask you about, is that raised a slight problem, because the reason that that we were able to sort of tell him in detail what that program would look like, and that he was able to offer that those cautionary words, was because it had been set out in quite a lot of detail in public. And so the Conservatives were committed to that if they'd taken office. In a sense, it was too late to change that that agenda. So in some senses, having these meetings and these discussions at a time that is by definition towards the end of a parliament, an opposition by that time has done quite a lot of the work already to decide what it wants to do, and the civil service are really only coming in at the very last minute to that. Do you think there's perhaps scope for having perhaps a longer process or a different process that might allow access to civil servants at an earlier point in the policymaking process?
I don't think you can have this equivalent access talks going on for too long. I think it distorts the process. I think it would lose the urgency of, you know, we are having a shared discussion about what you might do in the immediate aftermath of this election that is coming up. And I think the fact that there's an election coming up focuses minds for access talks as they currently work. But you do raise a really important point, which is about the literacy of the opposition when it comes to how government really works, their sort of understanding of that, but also the quite understandable pulls that are on opposition parties to be able to make promises to, you know, try and sell their wares and get attention from the public, which quite understandably leads you to wanting to make bold offers of what you can try to do. And also the pressure that you get from the media to give specificity to that. And so for a lot of times, yes, setting out a timetable or conveying your urgency by saying in the first 100 days, we're going to achieve all these things. That is both really important in terms of parties' offer to the public and also the pressure that they are under from the media. But I think you can only really address that by educating people about the problems of all of that. And you know, you've just raised it, that those kinds of promises of everything you're going to achieve early in the government, you've got to be really cautious about that because things do take longer. And it's not some, you know, oh, everything's so much slower and oh, if it could only be quicker. It's just reality. You know, legislation doesn't come out of nowhere. Coordinating policy across multiple different departments is really complicated. Working out the delivery systems of what you're trying to achieve, you know, that takes time. There isn't a sort of a magic switch, a magic lever that you get into government and then suddenly you can make all these promises happen in no time at all. So it's both being conscious of that as an opposition party and for the media to be conscious of that as well. But I think there is a separate question, which is about simply the resources that opposition parties have. And, you know as well as I do, there's been lots of debates about, is it worth having a department for the opposition? So a particular bunch of civil servants who would be able to support opposition parties. I'm less in favour of that, purely because I think it slightly distorts the civil service serving the government of the day. But I do think they need the equivalent resources. And for me, the issue is around the resources that all politicians are provided in Parliament. You know, they do incredibly massive jobs when you think about the amount of constituency work they do, on top of, if you're a select committee member, that kind of work, on top of scrutinising government policy. And if you are a member of the front bench, on top of both critiquing the government and also coming up with plans for an alternative government. And yet, by and large, we, you know, resource them to have one person, often in their 20s, who is supporting them across a whole range of work there. They'll have a bit more support on constituency work. If they're in the front bench, you know, through short money or through the party's money, they'll have maybe some extra advisors helping them on the development of policy. But even so, you're talking about teams of fewer than five people. In a lot of cases, it is just one person that they're very largely relying on. And that's incredible for the job that they're doing. And I do think, I know we get squeamish about public money going towards our MPs, but I do think if we want quality MPs providing a quality service, we need to think about resourcing them professionally. And I think, you know, better resources and supporting those people doing those jobs would be something that we should focus on a bit more.
Mm. Well, it's very interesting to hear you say that. That's something of a soapbox that I've been on for quite a few years about the resourcing of the opposition specifically. But I think your point about resourcing all MPs better, I think, is also important. I have to say my own solution, which I expound upon a bit in the conclusion of my tome of a book that's just come out, is to actually beef up the House of Commons library. Because I think that's one of the great unsung resources of our democracy. People out there really don't know that there is this resource that's available. A lot of MPs don't really know there's this research resource available to them. And I think the best shadow ministers and the best MPs do make great use of that, because they've got subject specialists there who do know their stuff, and whose job there is to sort of focus on particular areas of policy. And I think if we beef that up, and had more people working on that, some of them perhaps, as I suggest, could be working specifically for the opposition, that would provide a counterpoint to some extent, and also some permanence to that. But it also, of course, depends quite a lot on how seriously the opposition itself takes policy making and preparations for government. So is that part of the problem as well, that there's quite a lot of difference between how front benchers will approach this part of the job? They're obviously quite concerned, and we heard a lot about it in the panel the other week, about just winning the election. I remember Kate Fall saying, you know, there's really not enough headspace to think about very much else apart from just getting on and winning the election, and everything else about sort of how you're going to govern when you're in power is sort of pushed to the margins. And even Tony Blair, I think, was very keen to push that to the side, even though it was quite clear that he was going to win the election. So is that part of the issue as well, that it needs the opposition themselves to focus on this when they don't necessarily have the political imperative to do it?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think there's slightly different issues. There's the, you know, do you resource up a preparation for government team who are taking your manifesto policies and other commitments and thinking about, okay, how much detail do we need to work on these to be ready if we take up government, if we win the election? And then there's a second question, which is how robust are policies and promises that politicians make generally? And I think when it comes to the latter, our media and think tanks and other, you know, critics or commentators are very good at keeping people honest, of sort of pressing on what's the feasibility of this, how realistic is it, what would be involved in implementation, what's the costing of it, and so forth. So there is quite a lot of challenge on politicians, on opposition parties to come up with policies that are realistic and, you know, dare I say it, might even solve problems rather than just promising them. But it is always going to be a natural tension that you want to promise the earth to get elected, but also you want to promise something realistic. You know, it goes back to, was it Dennis Healy, The Art of the Possible? So that's a natural tension that I think exists in politics. And I think it's quite a healthy tension, because we want our politicians to be ambitious. It was interesting, you mentioned the report. In the research for that, we took some people from Canada. And one of the people we talked to, a political appointee, was quite eloquent on this point, that he thought the role of politicians was to push the civil service, and it was important to have that separation when you were doing opposition policy making, that you're able to come up with ambitious ideas and bring hope to the country and think afresh about new ideas of what you can do, and not have it always be sort of brought back to the basics of, oh, it's very difficult, it's very hard, and so forth. So I do think we do need that ambition from our politicians, and we do need that tension, but it does need to be tempered in terms of making sure that the public, you know, can have trust in their politicians, that things will be achieved, and also, you know, that it's not just saying activities that you'll do, but you're also focusing on outcomes you want to achieve. You know, are the policies you're announcing going to change the thing that you want to change?
Mm. And looking at that report, it goes rather wider than the previous report that you worked on quite a few years ago now, on transition to government. It's called Preparing for Government, How the Official Opposition Should Ready Itself for Power. As I say, it does go a bit broader than just the access talks regime. It looks at sort of the way that the opposition itself should prepare for the challenges of government. What are the main lessons that that you think they should draw from that?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about one of them, which is policy making and the ways in which you have to think about the priorities that you've got for government, the sequencing of work that you've got. If you're going into a King's Speech in the first legislative session, you know, you have a finite amount of bills that you can bring forward. And how do you therefore turn ideas into reality, and how do you turn them into a programme plan? So there's quite a bit of that. I think what's particularly different is in this one, we went a lot further into preparing people in particular, which is something that obviously I have worked on throughout my time at the IFG, the last 15 years since that report was first written. And there, I think ideas have moved on. There is still an expectation that, you know, it's hard to prepare for government, given that it's just such a huge shock. Until you're in it, you don't really know it. But I think you can still prepare people for that shock. You can still tell them what a whirlwind it would be. You can, explain to them what their first day will be like, what it's like to have your diary taken over by the civil service, what it's like to suddenly have a red box and have, you know, be inundated by decisions and very little time to consider them. So there's a much better and I think more, you know, practical approach to how you can prepare people, given that you've got finite resources, limited time, and you want to focus on the campaign. And, you know, ultimately, you won't know until you're in it what it's really like. We also, though, focus on just building a team generally. I think it is something that we discuss too little in talking about government. We're all focused very much on policies and policy implementation. It's all very mechanistic, and we don't realize that actually most of government is a human element. It's really, we can, you know, look back at the Boris Johnson government and all this stuff that's been coming out in the COVID inquiry, and you can see that there's a huge amount of the dysfunction in number 10 comes down to human behaviors, you know, whether it's people battling with each other, sending rude WhatsApps, or whether it's the prime minister and the way in which they approach the concept of team. We don't really talk about that much. We don't talk about ministers as a team of ministers working together. We often see it as a sort of combative approach of ministers trying to compete with each other. Similarly, departments, it's all, you know, discussion of competition and bargaining and so forth. And those are important elements, but I think there is more that we can think about how you build successful teams and have them working over a sustained period of time. It's, you know, perhaps a little bit optimistic of me to think that we can edge out all of the sort of more negative impacts that politics have on those aspects of government. But I think we could go a bit further towards recognising its value.
Mm. And looking at the history of different transitions, as you have done, are there some that have done it better than others? And what are the ones that have perhaps done it less well? What are the sort of the examples that you can pick out of those that have done it well and badly?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the step change actually probably occurred with 2010 in terms of prep for government work in detail. So Nick Bowles and Francis Maud led a team who worked in quite some depth to try and turn plans for the policy plans into business plans. So into a sort of detailed pack that every single shadow would have about what they were trying to implement. Obviously, reality hit them. Coalition government meant quite a lot of changes to that. You know, talking to us, they say that actually they're quite proud that still a lot that was in the business plans through the coalition government programme for government ended up being the sort of things that were then implemented. But then you have the big changes that the coalition brought, particularly in Duncan Smith going into Department for Work and Pensions, which brought universal credit in, which wasn't part of any of those plans. We also now know that Andrew Lansley had plans for the NHS that weren't really discussed amongst the opposition. They were much more his own personal interpretation of them that then, once they got into government, started go off the rails somewhat, and you know, they had the famous pause and it ended up in a very different place. And similarly, Theresa May, she wasn't the Shadow Home Secretary. She ended up in that job and, you know, pretty much started from scratch. In her case, she was able to, you know, manage the role. I mean, she's one of, I think, longest serving Home Secretary, shows that she personally had success in managing the role. But we also know, obviously, all of the problems that the Home Office has had, including Windrush, including immigration, you know, which sort of persist to this day. So there's still problems, no matter how much preparation for government you do. So, but 2010 is a good example. 2015, the Ed Miliband opposition did a lot of very similar work, and I think drew on the work that the Conservatives had. And I think that's something that's not discussed, that actually oppositions from both sides of the aisle learn from each other. Much more than I think people realise. And again, it's one of the reasons why we wrote this report, was because I don't think opposition should have to start from scratch every single time. You know, we know how a lot of this stuff works well. So it's worth setting it down so that future oppositions have some basis on which they can start doing similar work and know what a good model looks like. It's worth saying, I mean, the 97 transition was in many ways very successful, obviously a big part down to the success that they had at the ballot box, and that in some respects covers up all other ills. You know, you've got such a sizable majority, it's very easy for whatever you do to seem incredibly successful. But we know there that the Bank of England's independence plans weren't discussed in access talks. They went off well, but there were still some problems in implementation. On the other hand, also know that the Constitution Unit at University College London worked quite extensively on plans for devolution, and that contributed a great deal to the success in which they were implemented in 1998 and 99.
Is there ever a problem of over-preparation? I'm thinking back to quite a long way back to Edward Heath in 1970, where, again, I think because of his own mindset, he was quite keen to have detailed plans put in place. It's often been said about him that he was a sort of frustrated civil servant himself in his sort of managerial approach. But of course, then once in office, those plans famously were blown off course. Is that something that that can be a problem, of actually becoming too rigidly attached to a plan? Or is that just the stuff of politics? That's just what happens in government sometimes.
Well, both are true. It is what happens, and therefore you shouldn't stick too rigidly, or you shouldn't assume. I think every government, and this is certainly what I say to both politicians and to civil servants, you should always be, I say, expect the unexpected, which is a bit of a catch-all for me, but it's true. Something will always come to bite you, something that, you know, the civil service didn't realise was going to be an issue in the first few weeks, or just, you know, a small mistake that then blows up into something massive. I'm thinking of, you know, Caroline Spelman finding herself having to apologise for, you know, trying to sell off the forests in 2010, or the Department for Education failing to get the right list of schools whose funding was being cancelled through Building Schools for the Future programme again in 2010. Both, you know, mistakes that would have felt to people at the time like they came out of nowhere and slightly blew them off course. But yes, Ted Heath is the classic example I give of where you can over prepare. Honestly, the best thing that was said to me was that it's not about the plans, it's the planning. So it's the process of going through preparing for government and making your plans that helps you have conversations about prioritisation, start thinking about sequencing, start thinking about implementation challenges, which mean that you're a bit more prepared so that when you're having those conversations at speed, under huge pressure in the early days of government, you've done it, you've been round the houses a bit on it. You know, it's not that whatever you did in opposition, you can then just say, right, let's sit back, here's my plans, let's implement them. It's that it prepares you a bit for what's going to hit you if and when you get into government, and that's the best you can hope for.
Mm. And looking at the current opposition and looking at Keir Starmer and his team, how seriously do you think they are taking the process? And do you get a sense of how prepared they are and how aware they are of the need to do this?
I think they are. I mean, they've talked about the work that they've been doing with the institutes. Obviously, that's confidential, so I can't talk about that. But I think they are learning from those predecessors that I have talked about. They do have a similar team. They've got Sue Gray, who has been at the heart of government, dealing with preparation for government, changes of government, how it all operates from that side of the fence. And, you know, they clearly have an internal process, you know, where departments are all connected up, the sort of the importance of Rachel Reeves' position, thinking about the overarching fiscal envelope, thinking about their sort of overarching approach towards the fiscal situation that they are likely to inherit, which is pretty, you know, stark at the moment. Means that it is, I think, focusing minds. And I think, you know, since the polls widened after the Truss government and suddenly Labour were consistently getting this poll lead, I think that has also sharpened minds. But we're also seeing from the briefing that's coming out in the newspapers that, you know, they're very keen to make sure that there is no complacency. I think that's the tagline that they're using. And it's not surprising when you think about sort of successive elections that in some cases, you know, the polls in advance didn't quite suggest would go that way. We were talking about hung parliaments in 2015, not expecting a majority government, you know, the 2017, 2019 elections. And the same was true in 2010, talking to people recently, again, sorry for our own podcast series, you know, they talk about how in 2010 there wasn't, you know, there was almost that relief that actually you'd managed to get into government, because again it was a government that was in a party who had lost successive elections, and at various times it felt really difficult to get back into government. So I think any opposition approaching this, yes, they take preparation for governing seriously, but what they take really seriously is the election itself, and try not to take for granted, no matter what poll lead they've got, what might happen.
Mm. Indeed, it's quite familiar hearing Labour now talking about no complacency. I remember in the 97 election, Tony Blair making that a bit of a mantra as he went around the country, and cautioning anyone who got overexcited, even on the night, I think, as well, which is quite extraordinary. You mentioned Sue Gray there, and of course, that's an appointment that has created quite a lot of comment. We did an emergency podcast last year when that was announced to talk about that, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that. It sparked a period of a review, and she had to sort of go on gardening leave for a bit before she could take up the position. It's an interesting one there, because as you say, it's quite obvious why Keir Starmer would want her to work for him, not least to do this work, but also looking ahead into government to have someone like that who knows what they're doing. But is that appointment a problematic one in terms of the civil service? It was one that created a bit of controversy, but I seem to recall that there was a bit of caution also from the Institute about that, because of the way that sparked accusations of politicisation. What are your thoughts on that now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the timing and the context for the announcement, and it wasn't even an announcement, it leaked out, was a problem, because, I mean, obviously it undermined trust from ministers, and I think the civil service are wary about that. I can imagine that fellow permanent secretaries felt blindsided by it as well. And I think some of that was about Sue Gray herself, having both done the report that she'd done into Party Great, but also being the person that she was and being so much at the centre of everything. I think we do have to recognise that people who work in public life, whether they're civil servants in arm's length bodies, working in Parliament or whatever, you know, at some point or another might decide to work more directly for a political party. In some cases, that might be down to their own political leaning. In other cases, it might just be that they want to have a more direct influence. But there are plenty of other examples. We know that Harold Wilson was a civil servant before David Willetts was a civil servant. Lord Frost was a civil servant. So there's plenty of examples where people cross over into far more political positions, perhaps not having had quite as sensitive and senior a role in the context in which it occurred as Sue Gray did in that moment. But I think we've got to recognise that there's some fluidity. It's just that you've got to think how to manage that process. And I imagine that Sue herself regrets the way in which it came out. But it's very difficult to apply for a job that is so sensitive and not tell people about it. And, you know, we see other problems in terms of politicians and the kinds of jobs that they go into and how they use business appointment rules and all the rest of it. So I think there's all sorts of problems that we've got around how people move around from sensitive government positions into other jobs. And the questions were rightly asked about Sue Gray. And I think, you know, deciding to give that pause was very important.
Mm. But now that she is in that role and obviously will be quite closely involved in this process of access talks, I imagine, how important is that role now of chief of staff to the leader of the opposition going into government? We would assume that she would perhaps take up the posts of chief of staff in number 10, Keir Starmer, to become prime minister. We're now used to that as a model. That's quite a recent change, isn't it, to have that that position there? I mean, I say recent, I'm talking as an historian, of course, because, of course, it's about 30 years old, really, with Jonathan Powell being the first of those type of political chiefs of staff. But it seems very much to be a recognition that an aspirant prime minister needs to identify that key figure. And we've seen all sorts of problems, as you alluded to, in governments recently where they can't quite find the right person to hold the thing together. It seems to be more successful for those coming from opposition into government that they find someone who is actually quite good at that, whether it's Ed Llewellyn or Jonathan Powell, as I say, have been quite successful in that role. Is that a recognition that's a model that's here to stay and is actually working quite well, that in number 10 we do have quite a well-established sort of political core now to government, and that's something which can be brought from opposition?
I think I'm going to caveat again, we do and we don't. So I think it is important that we now recognise that there is a senior political advisor type role around the prime minister that is incredibly important and which can help organise a government and take some of the pressure off of the prime minister and organise the political side of things. But we also, in the UK, that role is quite fluid. So, you know, there has been some discussion about when is the chief of staff actually doing a chief of staff role, and when are they slightly doing the PPS role, the principal private secretary role, and what is the difference between the two? And I think in the UK it depends on the individual whether they're clear about that and whether they know how to operate in that way. I think in the US it's a more clearly defined role in terms of managing a huge political team. Whereas in the UK, it can often be somebody who is man marking the prime minister or providing a barrier, you know, between all this stuff that's coming into the prime minister and them, sometimes too much of a barrier, as happened under Theresa May. So it still really depends on both who is appointed to that role, the way in which they approach the role and their sort of personal temperament, and also the prime minister and whether they're comfortable with that. I don't think under Boris Johnson there was ever a sort of perfect solution for that. You know, there was some confusion as to whether Dominic Cummings was or was not chief of staff. The reality was he was sort of supremo political advisor because he just had that seniority and that political weight around the building. But I don't think he staffed the prime minister in that way. And Gavin Barwell's book on it is very eloquent about how he saw the role. And he particularly emphasises that phrase that ultimately, you know, the most important word there is staff. You are staffing the chief. You know, it's not that you are the chief yourself. And so there is probably something about sort of ongoing education about what that role could be, an ongoing definition of what that role is. But as I say, a lot of the times it is just about, it goes back to my point about teamwork and the human element. Often it is about just finding the right character who works for you and your character as a prime minister. So the key test for Keir Starmer in opposition is Sue Gray the right character for you and providing you with what you need? And one assumes that she is, in which case, yes, absolutely, taking the that robust relationship into government is an excellent opportunity.
Mm. And finally, just sticking with that human element, as you mentioned, looking at preparing people for government, there are some in the shadow cabinet who have been ministers before. Some of them have been cabinet ministers before, which wasn't the case in 1997, for example. But there will be quite a lot of new cabinet ministers if Labour comes to office. And without breaching the confidence of any training that the Institute might do for those people, what do you think are the most important or the most surprising lessons that you think that a shadow minister should know about going into government, which perhaps hadn't occurred to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk about this a lot in, you know, reports that we've written, but also we have now quite a lot of published guides for potential new ministers. So we have, you know, short sort of 2-pager guides on our website. We've also got slightly longer ones, sort of explaining to them how to do certain things in government, how to, you know, how to outsource contracts, how to deal with your department's budget and so forth. For me, actually, again, some of the human side of it is the most important. One of the things is that it can feel very much like everything's being done to you. The civil service is very good at grabbing a new minister and sort of putting this protective seal around them. And suddenly, you know, your diary is being managed, your life is being managed, all the papers, the rhythm of how you work, the decisions you're supposed to make, the meetings you're in and so forth. Feels like you're just a cog in the system and it's all being done to you. And so one of the things that our Ministers Reflect archive of interviews with former ministers helps us to explain to people is that actually you can grab control of that back. You know, it is your diary. Who you want to meet is up to you. The priorities that you feel need to be focused on are up to you. When you want to have your red box, how your red box is organized, how short your submissions are, the way in which the department is communicating with you. You know, these are all things that more experienced ministers learn how to handle. So it can feel very difficult to kind of try and grab back that agency. And it is sometimes tricky. Obviously, you know, we have in recent years talked a lot about the relationship between ministers and civil servants and how it can go wrong when ministers are almost too pushy. And it's certainly when it falls into bullying. But I think when it's an open, honest conversation with, you know, people that are just trying to get to know each other and work more successfully together, it can be healthy for the minister to feel like they can have a bit more control over how they are operating as a minister. And similar to that is a bit of self-reflection about how you operate. And that might be just understanding if, like, do you like reading long documents or do you prefer sitting in a meeting and discussing stuff? And it might sound like something basic, but it's fundamental to how the department then treats you. You know, one of my favourite stories about transitions is from 1997, where they were very used to Ken Clark, who loved these sort of big, open, almost seminars where everyone could come along and pitch their thoughts and throw around ideas. And soon after Gordon Brown came into the Treasury, they had such a meeting and it was an absolute disaster because it isn't how he operated. And he wanted things to go through his key advisors and papers to be sent to him. And it wasn't comfortable in that Ken Clark type operation. So for the department, working that out early on makes a huge difference to how they then treat you as a minister. So that's really important as well. And then the final thing I think is just that sense of your priorities, but also understanding, you know, what's going on in the department. We've obviously been talking about the post office scandal a lot recently. Making sure that you're open to bad news is incredibly important. But similarly, you know, understanding the pressure of needing to make decisions and how difficult it is, and appreciating, you know, what that's going to be like for you personally. Are you good at making decisions, or, you know, do you find that you need time? In which case, how is that going to happen in government when you don't have the time? So, again, it's the human element side of it, but these are all really useful things to be contemplating.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed. And if there are any shadow ministers listening to this who want some more detail, I'm sure they will be getting it either in person or they can get a sneak preview by reading that excellent new report, Preparing for Government, published just a few weeks ago by the Institute for Government. And of course, as I mentioned, the panel discussion that took place, which you can also watch that in full online as well. Kath, it's going to be a very busy year. I'm sure we'll probably speak again. But if people want to hear you on a more regular basis, you're sitting there in your podcast studio for Inside Briefing. No jealousy here. People can go and listen to that as well as Opposition Cast. But for the moment, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks, Nigel.
Yes, you see, I'm very magnanimous. I'm very happy to plug other people's podcasts as well as this one. But seriously, I'm very grateful to the Institute for Government for that brilliant event that we heard the clips from earlier in the programme on how to prepare for government. And I think any focus on the opposition is something that we at the Centre for Opposition Studies are very keen to encourage. So it's great that the IFG are doing that. So do go and check out that report that they've just brought out. And also you can watch that event as well online. That's just about all we've got for you on this episode. It's great to be back. I really do enjoy doing this podcast, and it's been a shame I've not been able to do so for quite some time. But I'm really looking forward to this year, as we have a very dramatic time in politics coming up, having some more discussions with interesting people, and I hope you'll join me for those. So make sure you are subscribed wherever you get your podcasts from, so that you are notified when we upload a new episode, and do go back and listen to some of the earlier ones if you haven't done so already. But until then, thanks very much indeed for joining me. Look after yourselves, and I'll see you again soon. You've been listening to Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies, presented by me, Nigel Fletcher. Our theme music is by Tom Hector, and you can find us on Twitter at @OppositionUK and online at oppositionstudies.net.
New year, new nonsense.